KSVP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I don't tell my friend Elon how to, I don't argue with him about how to build rockets, and I wish he wouldn't argue with me about how to craft legislation and pass it.
In the meltdown between Donald Trump and Elon Musk, congressional Republicans are trying not to get burned.
It's Friday, June 6th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, Jordan promised to take 2,000 sick children from Gaza.
So why have only a few dozen arrived?
There has been difficulties imposed by the Israeli authorities that is stopping the way of making this happen smoothly.
Later, the Department of Homeland Security wants some 20,000 National Guard troops to help with immigration enforcement.
And the book The Spinach King unmasks a man who built a frozen food empire in New Jersey.
He was just a man who could not share.
Plus, what archaeologists learned from a much older farming site in Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Trump administration has returned Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the man wrongly deported to El Salvador almost 3 months ago, back to the U.S., where he faces criminal charges from a grand jury in Tennessee that charged him with conspiracy to transport undocumented people. Attorney General Pam Bondi.
The grand jury found that over the past 9 years, Abrego Garcia has played a significant role in an alien smuggling ring. They found this was his full-time job, not a contractor.
And she says that included allegedly transporting children. Abrego Garcia's deportation was at the center of a political and legal battle over the Trump administration's immigration policies. That case went to the Supreme Court, which told the administration to facilitate his return. ICE agents are encountering protesters during operations, leading to warnings by federal officials against interference with immigration enforcement. NPR's Martin Costi says in the past week, there have been confrontations in San Diego, Chicago, and Minneapolis.
Some protesters say they object to the deportation of people without criminal records. Others say they don't like the way ICE agents have gone about their work wearing masks and tactical gear. In Minneapolis, Ryan Perez is with a group called COPAL, which trains volunteers to monitor ICE operations.
The most important thing is that nobody is here to obstruct in the moment and enforcement. We need to collect the evidence, ask the questions, take the photos, and then move to our trusted legal partners to determine in court, if necessary, if violations have occurred.
Homeland Security officials say agents wear masks because some have received death threats, and a DHS official warned that anyone impeding ICE's work could face prosecution. Martin Costi, NPR News.
The feud between Elon Musk and Donald Trump that started on the internet could end up in space. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, observers are concerned that it could disrupt business between the government and Musk's firm, SpaceX.
SpaceX does a huge amount of work for the government, and the government spends billions on SpaceX. Tim Ferrer is an analyst who follows the space industry.
SpaceX counts on the U.S. government for a substantial part of its revenues. The government counts on SpaceX for critical launch services and many defense programs.
Those defense programs include spy satellites and communications. Both Musk and Trump have threatened that relationship during their feud. Trump said he might cancel Musk's contracts. Musk responded by posting that he decommissioned the SpaceX capsule used by NASA astronauts. He since deleted the post. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Wall Street higher by the closing bell. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Supreme Court granted DOGE access to information collected by the Social Security Administration. That includes Social Security numbers, medical and mental health records, and family court information. The justices, acting at the request of the Trump administration, overturned actions by two lower courts that had limited DOGE's access to sensitive private information. In a separate order, the court ruled that DOGE is not required to provide internal documents to a Washington watchdog group in advance of larger proceedings regarding a Freedom of Information Act request. For the second year, Muslims in Gaza won't be able to celebrate one of Islam's most important holidays, devastated by Israeli bombardments, and only with a trickle of aid that's allowed into the territory. Palestinians have no access to fresh food and meat, a mainstay of Eid celebrations. NPR's Kerry Khan has more from Tel Aviv.
If Palestinians are able to find meat or livestock to slaughter for the Festival of Sacrifice, the prices are astronomical. Israel's nearly three-month-long blockade of all goods into Gaza depleted food stocks. There's been a limited lifting of the ban, but only a trickle of trucks have been allowed into Gaza since, bringing in mainly flour. The UN, which is warning of widespread famine in Gaza, says it struggles to deliver aid due to looting and shifting Israeli military restrictions. Israel says it must impose strict controls to make sure Hamas doesn't steal aid. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. What happens after two of the most powerful men in the world publicly tear each other apart on social media? Well, today the answer seems to be mostly awkward silence. President Trump and Elon Musk created a lot of drama yesterday, flinging accusations at each other from the social media platforms they each own. NPR's Stephen Fowler is here to tell us about the fallout. Hi there.
Hey, Ari.
Yesterday afternoon, it was like Godzilla versus King Kong stomping across X and Truth Social. What's it looking like today?
Well, to continue your pop culture references, if yesterday's theme was the girls are fighting, today it's more like new phone, who this?
Okay.
Trump made the rounds calling reporters at prominent mainstream media outlets, basically saying he's moved on from Musk and won't speak to him. And Elon Musk has been uncharacteristically quiet online, just a few posts here and there about his companies. The main pain point has been Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill that's a reconciliation measure chock full of Trump's agenda items, including tax cuts, but that experts say would increase the federal deficit by trillions over the next several years.
The House passed that bill. It was looking dicey in the Senate even before Musk called it an abomination. So what are you hearing from Republicans in Congress about what the Musk-Trump breakup means for them and for this bill?
Well, in the immediate aftermath, there's been a lot more diplomacy among those in congressional leadership positions. House Speaker Mike Johnson said he exchanged texts with Musk, but gently pushed back at the billionaire's core criticism about the reconciliation bill. He talked about that in an interview with CNBC this morning.
I don't tell my friend Elon I don't argue with him about how to build rockets, and I wish he wouldn't argue with me about how to craft legislation and pass it. But, you know, we've had some good discussion. I thought it was helpful, fruitful, but, you know, it's just disappointing. I hope it all resolves today.
It is worth pointing out that much of this discourse and about the drama is just taking place online and on the airwaves for now.
From the beginning, Elon Musk and Donald Trump have had priorities that overlap in some ways and diverge in others. And at the Oval Office yesterday, Trump pointed out that his former aides and allies have often turned against him.
They leave and they wake up in the morning and the glamour's gone, the whole world is different, and they become hostile. I don't know what it is.
So, Stephen, do you think this was inevitable?
I mean, one way or another, yeah. Musk seems to just now discover that the push to cut taxes but not cut spending on some things like Social Security and the military has been the vibe for Trump and congressional Republicans all along. Trump and congressional Republicans have touted Musk's Doge initiative to cut federal spending without acknowledging that effort never really focused on big-ticket items. And while Musk and Trump do both have business backgrounds, the former has never really shown remotely the same level of understanding of how government or politics works the way Trump does. Elon Musk doesn't have a lengthy background of conservative views socially or fiscally, and the pairing has always been one more about personal convenience and power more than this ideological alignment.
And also about money. Musk spent more than $250 million in last year's election to help Trump and other Republicans get elected. He posted on X that Republicans would have lost the election and seats in Congress without him, and he accused Trump of ingratitude. So what does Musk believe Trump owes him as a return on investment?
Well, Musk has already gotten a lot out of this relationship with Trump, more than just a ceremonial key to the White House. There are federal agencies that were investigating Musk companies that they've been prime targets of the Doge dismantling effort. Musk has traveled with Trump on overseas trips that have also seen business deals come out of it. And those businesses are still federal contractors receiving billions of taxpayer dollars.
And just briefly, what do you see as the future consequences of this falling out?
Well, Musk was already on his way out of Trump's political sphere and orbit. He spent a lot of money in a Wisconsin Supreme Court race that backfired. He said he was pulling back from spending to focus on his business empire. And he's become the face of the unpopular parts of dismantling the federal government. This falling out could be a catalyst for sweeping Doge under the rug for Republicans to distance themselves from it and Musk in the coming year.
NPR's Stephen Fowler, thank you.
Thank you.
The nation of Jordan is treating seriously ill and injured Palestinians from Gaza, including dozens of child cancer patients. They are among 2,000 children King Abdullah promised President Trump back in February to bring in for treatment. So far, though, only 39 have arrived. NPR's Gina Raff has more from Amman.
The King Hussein Medical Center, one of the region's leading cancer hospitals, is huge and gleaming. Their floor-to-ceiling windows, stocked snack machines. It's a stark contrast to what some of its latest patients have come from. Zainab al-Astan arrived 2 weeks ago from Gaza with her sons, Qasim, who's 15, and Ahmed, 13. Both have lymphoma. Displaced repeatedly by Israeli airstrikes, the family lived in a tent. There's hardly any food, not even bread. Here, Estan says, Ahmed can't get enough of chicken sandwiches. Qasim describes trying to get treatment in Gaza amid the attacks on hospitals and shortages of medical supplies. The UN says there isn't a single fully functional hospital or clinic in Gaza, with its population of around 2 million people. Israel says its attacks that have hit hospitals target the militant group Hamas.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to have King Abdullah with us.
In February at the White House, Jordan's King Abdullah made this offer to President Trump.
One of the things that we can do right away is take 2,000 children that are either cancer children or in a very ill state to Jordan as quickly as possible.
But almost 4 months later, only 39 patients have arrived.
There has been difficulties imposed by the Israeli authorities that is stopping the way of making this happen smoothly.
That's Jordan's Minister for Government Communications, Mohammed Momani.
We will take these children to treat them, but then after they finish their treatment, they should be going back to their homeland.
This week, more than 24 more patients and their guardians were stranded in Gaza when Israel barred them from leaving, according to Jordanian officials. The Israeli military and the UN's World Health Organization, which oversees evacuation logistics, did not respond to a request for comment. Cancer Center Pediatrics Chief Rawad Rahani says while most childhood cancers are curable, recent arrivals are a special case.
What we're seeing, which is really particular to Gaza patients, more advanced diseases. When the tumor is very advanced, with the lack of proper treatment and proper evaluation, proper diagnosis, which makes them very hard to treat.
Rahani says some of the tumors are so big they've damaged the children's organs. Many of the children are malnourished. The combination means not all will make it.
Some of them are very advanced and some went to palliative care.
Another patient, Suhair Zaroub, 13, has a much better prognosis. She was diagnosed 2 months ago with leukemia and will undergo chemotherapy. Before the war between Israel and Hamas shut down all the schools in Gaza, Zaroub was a star pupil with a 98% grade point average. Zaroub says in a quiet voice, it's very nice here, but Gaza is more beautiful. She wants to go back after treatment. There's nothing better than home, she says. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
The Upper Peninsula of northern Michigan is not known as a big farming area, but that's where archaeologists have found an ancient agricultural site, and it's surprisingly vast. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, its size suggests that large-scale farming by Native Americans was common before European settlers arrived.
Some people might imagine that pre-colonial Native Americans were mostly nomads or hunter-gatherers, but Jesse Cassana says that's not the case at all. He's an archaeologist with Dartmouth College and says starting about 1,000 years ago, more and more groups became full-time farmers.
So that by the time colonists arrived, you know, what they were encountering were a lot of pretty sedentary communities all over North America who were practicing various forms of farming.
It's been hard, though, to know the true extent of this agriculture because the best farmland got taken over, plowed up, and developed over the centuries, erasing signs of past practices. But there was this one forested spot in Upper Michigan, along the Menominee River, where archaeologists had been able to find some parallel rows of earth. These are the remains of the raised gardening beds built by the ancestors of the Menominee Indian tribe of Wisconsin. Madeline McLeister is also at Dartmouth. She says these raised bumps of earth are subtle and can be hard to discern if you're just walking around and looking. So she and her colleagues wanted to try mapping this area with a new technology, a drone equipped with a laser instrument.
It was really just a test more than anything else to see what could we see.
They flew the drone over more than 300 acres and were shocked to detect agricultural plots that were 10 times bigger than what had previously been mapped. The earth and rows just went on and on beyond the surveyed area.
There's at least like 500 acres of densely clustered ridge fields.
The find, reported in the journal Science, looks to be the largest preserved ancient agricultural system in the eastern part of the United States. And it's wowed other archaeologists. Susan Koyman is with Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville.
I was pretty blown away by how extensive these fields were.
She says clearing and cultivating this land would have required a lot of labor. And it suggests that researchers may have underestimated how widespread intensive agriculture was in this region of pre-colonial North America. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In the classic sci-fi movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, there is a blink-and-you'll-miss-it moment. One of the astronauts is on his way to the moon, sucking down some space food, and the food packet is labeled Seabrook Farms Liquipack. That shows how big Seabrook Farms was in the mid-20th century. In 1955, Life magazine called the New Jersey company the biggest vegetable factory on Earth. The family that owned and ran this farming empire was straight out of Succession, ruthless, backstabbing, and alcoholic. A new book tells this story. It's called The Spinach King, The Rise and Fall of an American Dynasty. And the author, John Seabrook, knows the characters well because they are his relatives. John Seabrook, welcome to All Things Considered.
Hey, Ari, delighted to be here.
What do you remember about your grandfather, the patriarch of this company, C.F. Seabrook?
Well, I only met my grandfather once toward the end of his life, and he was pretty far sunk into, I think, dementia probably at that point. So my only actual physical memory of him is a little scary. But I certainly grew up with his reputation, which was very august, very sort of shining, spectacular, accomplished man of America, great capitalist. The book begins with my father reading the obituary that the Times published about him, in which he's represented as a great man, a great industrialist, and a great builder.
Yeah, so that obituary described him as this sort of American titan who pioneered frozen food technology and changed the eating habits of the nation. Your book kind of unmasks him. Will you read from early on? This is page 14.
Yeah, there's a passage on page 14 that reads, "Ambition, energy, and ingenuity drove his rise, but violence and terror allowed him to maintain control. We often bury the details of how large fortunes are made, as the brutality underlying them is less inspiring to read about than the eureka moments of accomplishment. Had the obituary writer checked the Times' own morgue, they would have found front-page coverage of tear gas and billy clubs, mobsters and vigilantes, and the burning crosses of the KKK.
That's partly a reference to a farm worker strike that took place in 1934. How did your grandfather respond to that strike?
Yeah, so my grandfather was a man who enjoyed total control and was able to enforce total control for several decades in the first part of Seabrook Farms. But in the 1930s, the workers decided that they were fed up with their pay and with the practices of my grandfather. So they decided they'd had enough. And even though farm workers didn't have a lot of leverage when it came to unions, there was no union, they did have nature on their side, because there are certain times of the year when the work has to be done or
the food doesn't get picked, it'll rot in the field.
That's right. And so they chose one of those times and they struck, and they had the company over a barrel, and my grandfather was forced to concede to their demands. Then he took them back, they struck again, and that was when the vigilantes and the KKK and the violence took place. And that was in, July of 1934.
So he made a promise, broke that promise, and then responded with violence. How does this figure of your grandfather compare to either the diminished man who you have this memory of at the end of his life, or the towering figure that you were told about and read about as a child?
I think my grandfather contained many parts, and I wouldn't want to dismiss his accomplishments entirely, but he was unable to cede control either to his sons or to what eventually became the union at Seabrook Farms. he was just a man who could not share. He was an absolutist and an authoritarian. And as he aged, and I think his powers diminished, he had to exert extra means to hang on, and that included violence.
It seems that in your family, fathers and sons have betrayed and backstabbed each other in truly shocking ways for generations. And there are members of your family who view your writing this book as yet another betrayal. Do you think they're right?
That's a very difficult question to answer. Am I betraying my grandfather by telling the world what he was really like? I suppose you could look at it that way, but I sort of feel like these traumas that take place in families, whether you identify them and make them public or whether you keep them quiet and sweep it under the rug, they find their way down through the generations, kind of like water trickling through rocks. And they end up, you know, they see gravity, and that's the most recent generation. So I have a son and I have a daughter, and I certainly don't want that sort of, you know, wastewater seeping down into our relationship. And I wanted the truth out so that, you know, we are at least on a honest and firm basis for a relationship that I feel like is important.
There's a broad question about what any of us should do when our advantages come from the suffering of others. And I think many people in the U.S. benefit from the labor of people who were enslaved more than a century ago, which is something that we struggle with. But that is more abstract than what you lay out in this book, explaining how your particular family privileges were built on the misery of Seabrook farm workers. So how do you think about the obligations that come with that privilege, either in your life specifically or more generally?
One of the things I'm proudest of in this book is that for the first time, the migration stories of the African Americans who came to Seabrook Farms from the Deep South, from the Jim Crow South, has been told. So yes, certainly I owe a debt for my privileges that were based on the hardships of others. And in telling this book, I have tried to show those hardships and show how brave and how resolute these workers were. And in spite of my grandfather's attempt to crush them, were able to achieve a union and were able to achieve rights, you know, now are able to have their stories told for the first time. And those stories are now going to continue to be told. There's going to be a monument to the migrant workers that's created down in Seabrook as part of a Mellon Foundation grant. And I think, you know, finally, the black workers are getting their due that they never had before. So that, I'm very happy about that. I'm not saying that sort of makes up for all of the privileges that I received, but at least it gives me a certain amount of comfort.
How do you feel about eating frozen vegetables these days?
Well, you know, frozen vegetables, I feel like they always got a bad rap. They're actually, I mean, you know, a lot of times they're healthier for you.
If
a
fresh company ad for Seabrook Farms, frozen vegetables.
No. Try the cream spinach, kids. Try the cream spinach. You'll love it.
John Seabrook's new book is The Spinach King, The Rise and Fall of an American Dynasty. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ari. It's been really fun.
This is NPR News.
Set during the early years of NASA's space shuttle program, a novel about space catastrophe, love, and some of the first women in space.
I'm always curious about that moment. How do they make the world change in these small incremental ways?
Atmosphere by Taylor Jenkins Reid, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Republicans are complaining about the Congressional Budget Office. We'll explain what it is.
What's happening right now is that Republicans are somewhat embarrassed that their tax cuts are being scored as costing trillions over the decade.
Plus, the shift from acoustic pianos to digital.
After the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Maryland man who was deported by mistake to El Salvador almost 3 months ago is back in the U.S., where he's now been indicted. Kilmar Abrego Garcia is accused of conspiring to transport migrants illegally, as NPR Sergio Martinez Beltran reports.
According to the Department of Justice, Kilmar Abrego Garcia made money transporting migrants without legal status from Texas to other parts of the U.S., this over a span of 9 years, starting in 2016. The news comes as Abrego Garcia returns to the U.S. after being deported to El Salvador in March, despite a 2019 court order shielding him from removal to his home country. His case has become a flashpoint for both the Trump administration and immigrant rights advocates as a push to streamline deportations clashes with the requirements of due process. In a statement, Abrego Garcia's lawyer says the DOJ's move is, quote, an abuse of power, not justice. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News.
After a war of words exploded yesterday between President Trump and his former advisor, billionaire Elon Musk, over the GOP's massive tax and spending bill, another former Trump advisor, Steve Bannon, says Musk has crossed a point of no return.
He crossed the Rubicon. It's one thing to make comments about the spending on the bill. There's another thing about what he did, okay? You can't sit there and first of all try to destroy the bill. You can't come out and say kill the president's most important legislative occurrence of this first term.
Republicans are urging Trump and Musk to reconcile their differences. A former police chief and convicted killer who escaped from an Arkansas prison nearly 2 weeks ago has been captured. Authorities found Grant Hardin about a mile away from the prison grounds after he impersonated a corrections officer and was allowed to walk out of the facility. Hardin was serving lengthy sentences for murder and rape. This is NPR. Mpox cases, previously known as monkeypox, continue to rise across many African countries with over 64,000 suspected cases reported this year. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports the outbreak is most severe in Sierra Leone, where hospitals are struggling to keep up.
More than half of all new Mpox cases reported last week were in Sierra Leone. That's according to the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. At least 15 people have died, and there aren't enough hospital beds where patients with painful lesions and severe fever can be treated. The outbreak seems to be driven primarily through sexual contact. Vaccines could help get cases under control, but Sierra Leone has so far received a tiny fraction of the vaccines shipped to Africa since the outbreak took off last year, nowhere near enough to slow the spread. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
California air regulators are weighing a plan to phase out gas-powered furnaces and water heaters here in Southern California by 2027. Officials and supporters say reducing the harmful emissions would substantially improve respiratory issues, asthma attacks, and overall public health. But opponents of the proposal say it could raise consumer costs and strain the power grid. That phase-out would not be mandated, but manufacturers would have to pay a fee of $50 to $500 to sell gas-powered appliances here in California. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. 3 weeks ago, the Department of Homeland Security asked the Pentagon to provide 20,000 National Guardsmen to help in the Trump administration's deportation efforts. Now, a memo obtained by NPR provides new details about what those troops will be expected to do. One detail, some 6,000 of them will assist ICE agents in tracking down migrants and provide guard duty inside detention centers. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is here with more. Howdy, Tom.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, so as I understood it, the thinking was these National Guard troops would be there. They would be supporting ICE agents doing things like logistics, transportation. This sounds more like they may be actually involved in apprehensions.
That's right. And the White House wants to sharply increase deportation. So that's why they're asking for guard forces to help. Now, again, half of those 20,000 troops will provide transportation support, including what the memo calls, quote, rapid deployment shuttles for fugitive operations. But one category in the memo talks about using up to 2,400 guardsmen to what it calls, quote, attempt to locate fugitives. And that includes surveillance and, get this, quote, night operations and rural interdiction. It doesn't say what that second role exactly means, but it seems that these guardsmen would go after places such as large farms, vineyards, and other agricultural areas where many migrants work. I got the memo from an official who asked not to be named because it contains non-public information.
Got it. And the guardsmen, they would be helping with security, things like that, at detention centers?
That's right. The memo from Homeland Security to the Pentagon dated May 9th has another category called detention support, saying they need up to 2,500 guardsmen to work perimeter security, guard duty at contracted and federal detention facilities. And it also says these troops will provide emergency response inside these detention facilities, providing both riot control and search teams.
There were also questions, Tom, about where these guardsmen will come from, which states. Have we nailed that down?
You know, we don't know yet. I'm told by several sources that the expectation is if most, if not all, of these guardsmen, likely all volunteers, would come from states controlled by Republican governors, who'd be most amenable, of course, to Trump administration policies. And of course, many of those states are in the South. Already, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has called up his guard to work along the Mexican border. But this is far more widespread and, of course, would be all over the country in towns and cities. And I'm told there would be a particular focus on so-called sanctuary cities where local officials do not want to cooperate with such deportation efforts.
Okay, well, hold on there for a second, because that could be a big deal if local officials are reluctant to cooperate with all this.
Absolutely. And a big question, and one no one so far can address, is, will some of these guard troops from one state deploy to another state, including one where, let's say, the governor does not want to cooperate with what the memo calls, quote, expansive interior immigration enforcement operations. What caught my eye, Mary Louise, is some wording in the memo section that describes using up to 10,000 guard personnel for that transportation support. Mm-hmm. It says such support will be used for such work inside a state and also between states. So some officials wonder even if that's legal to use one state's guard to go to another state.
In a sentence or two, is there precedent for this?
No. Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island is an Army veteran. He said at a hearing yesterday, this is unprecedented. And he also said, is this right for the Army's image? But Mary Louise, I'm told this will go forward and likely begin as early as next month.
That's NPR's Tom Bowman. Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
Republican lawmakers and President Trump have been publicly complaining a lot about the Congressional Budget Office. It's a typically mundane, nonpartisan economic forecasting office. They're accusing it of playing politics with Trump's massive legislative effort known as the Big Beautiful Bill. So NPR's Barbara Sprunt is here to explain what the CBO actually does.
We've been hearing a lot about the CBO from congressional Republicans.
We're not buying the CBO's estimates.
The CBO has been wrong on tax cuts.
To see how wrong the CBO has been.
There's a lot not to like about the Congressional Budget Office.
That's House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senator Tim Scott, Congressman Steve Scalise, and Senator Rand Paul, just some of many Republicans venting frustration about the CBO's latest projection that signature GOP legislation meant to implement big swaths of President Trump's agenda, like extending the 2017 tax cuts, would increase federal deficits by about $2.4 trillion over a decade.
What's happening right now is that Republicans are somewhat embarrassed that their tax cuts are being scored as costing trillions over the decade.
That's Jessica Riedel, a senior fellow at the right-leaning Manhattan Institute.
After all, this is the party of self-styled deficit hawks. They're seeing this as a messaging problem where they can attack the scorekeepers.
But what exactly do budget scorekeepers do? Well, think of it like balancing your own household budget, but on steroids.
You go to the store and they tell you what the prices are. CBO is telling them what the prices are.
That's Doug Holtz-Aiken. He was director of CBO from 2003 to 2005.
And then Congress is saying, okay, if those are the prices, what does this add up to? What's the food? What's the gasoline? What is the rent going to be? Did we make our budget or not?
And just like you can make choices, regardless of what the calculator says, so can Congress. The CBO doesn't make any policy recommendations. It's up to lawmakers to decide what to do with the information they get. The CBO was established in the 1970s. Up until then, budget scorekeeping was done under the executive branch. The creation of the CBO meant Congress didn't have to depend on the White House, partisan by nature, to determine how much legislation would cost. Here's Riedel.
Congress doesn't have a lot of neutral, nonpartisan staffers that stick around regardless of the party in power, but CBO is one of those few offices.
It's a relatively small shop with less than 300 employees who typically produce 1,000 bill cost estimates a year.
Their projections certainly are not perfect, but projecting how new tax changes will affect the economic decisions of 330 million Americans is extraordinarily complicated.
And because there isn't an actual crystal ball out there, Holtz-Aiken says unforeseen events can upend original projections.
Forecasting the future is really, really hard. Things happen, like you have COVID, and the budget deficit goes from something sort of normal to $3 trillion in the space of 3 months. So, you know, yes, they're going to have some forecasting errors.
He says a common misconception is that there's a model for everything out there, and analysts just plug and chug.
Like, you know, you just drop the bill into a slot and out comes the answer. And the problem is CEO has the wrong model. They went to the wrong model shop and bought the wrong model. That's not at all what we're doing.
He says while there are reasonable criticisms on the timeliness of some of the CBO estimates over the years, concerns about partisanship are misplaced and that the CBO works hard to maintain objectivity. But he says CBO staffers know that criticism comes with the territory.
If you work there, you understand this. Okay, here we go. We're going to have this one big beautiful bill on the agenda. We're going to get yelled at, and let's just get through it.
But eventually lawmakers will get a score they're happy with and then heap praise on the CBO. Right?
When they're really happy, they say, we did a great job. When they're really unhappy, they say, CBO screwed this up. That's how that works.
Such is Washington. Barbara Spren, NPR News, The Capitol.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. If you've ever had to deal with hail damage, you know it can be a headache, an expensive headache. Well, research is underway to help make the forecasting of storms that produce hail more timely and accurate. Reporter and meteorologist Nick Gilmore with member station Radio IQ reports on one project working on that.
Okay, just imagine this. It's a warm afternoon. You're relaxing on your porch when a storm starts to roll over. You head indoors as rain begins to fall. As the cracks of thunder get louder, you peek out the window to see large chunks of ice on the ground. That's audio from a hailstorm in rural Virginia last month. If you really think about it, rain makes sense to fall from a storm, but large pieces of ice?
Hail is one of those things that we don't really know how it forms.
Sean Wah is a research scientist at NOAA Severe Storms Laboratory, we do know some of the basics. Strong thunderstorms have strong updrafts. Think like a vacuum cleaner that's able to lift moisture high up into the atmosphere. It's cold up there, so that water freezes into a small stone. It collects more water, refreezes as it cycles through the storm, more water, refreezes, you get the idea. Eventually, the hailstone gets too heavy and tumbles to the earth below. Waugh says wind speed, direction, and moisture in the air also play a part in hailstorm development. We also know hail can be expensive.
In any given year, it's 60 to 80% of the damage that comes from severe thunderstorms.
That's Ian Giamanco, a meteorologist at the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. He says we're just getting more hailstorms these days.
Rewind the clock all the way back to 2008. You know, every year since then, we've had over $10 billion in damage from hail. This has crept up now to a $20 to $30 billion problem.
Giamanco says that's why research like what Sean Waugh is doing is so important, finding out what hail looks like before it hits the ground. Here's Waugh.
All of our observations, basically as long as we've been doing hail research, is post-impact. We don't know what broke when it landed, how much of that mass or size or shape have we lost between when it fell and when we find it.
That information could help us better understand how hail shows up on radar in real time to maybe give folks in the way of a hailstorm a little more time to get to shelter. It could also help us know more about the size of the stones.
Most people want to know if there's going to be golf balls falling at their house or softballs falling at their house. There's a very big difference between those.
Juan and his team have built a complex rig that observes hail in free fall and in real time. They head out from Oklahoma, typically to the southern plains, to get the system in front of a storm producing large hail. The rig has high speed and high quality cameras, and Juan says there's another key component.
We need a lot of light to do that. Otherwise, the image would just be dark. So the LED array I have on the back of the truck produces about 30% more light than the sun. You actually need eclipse glasses standing behind the vehicle to look at it.
The imagery that comes back is breathtaking. Picture a black and white animation in slow motion, showing a large, unaltered hailstone plummeting to the ground before shattering into hundreds of pieces. Right now, Waugh is working on getting his system onto more trucks because it's hard to get in just the right place at the right time to capture large hail. So this is what a typical day in the office sounds like for him right now. For NPR News, I'm Nick Gilmore.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Some 9 million people in the U.S. rely on federal housing assistance. Now, currently, they can stay on it as long as they need. But NPR has learned the Trump administration is working on a rule to limit how long people can keep that aid to pay their rent. NPR's Jennifer Ludden is here with more. Hey there.
Hi.
Okay, tell me more about what exactly this proposed rule would do.
So it's not proposed yet. It's being written by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. But according to an internal document, it would allow local housing authorities to impose a time limit and also work requirements. I spoke to an agency staffer who did not want to be named because they're not authorized to speak to the media. They said the time limit in the draft rule was 2 years, but that may have changed. Now, none of this would apply to those who are elderly or disabled. And just to be clear, it's not something all local housing authorities would have to do. They could choose it if they wanted. Now, a HUD spokesperson would not provide details or even confirm there is a rule in the works.
Okay. Well, let's lay out what the stakes would be. I mean, what is the argument for imposing a cutoff date on housing assistance?
Well, you know, HUD Secretary Scott Turner says his agency's ultimate mission is to help people get off of subsidies and become self-sufficient. I also spoke with Howard Husick. He's at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, and he's been making this case for a while. He points out, you know, demand for rental aid way outstrips supply, and most people have to wait years to get it.
And there's a whole lot of people who qualify for this kind of aid who don't receive it. So there's an inefficient use of our housing because people can stay so long.
He says a time limit could spread this aid to more people, although Husick thinks that 2 years is too short.
So if the housing secretary wants people to become self-sufficient, do we have data? Is there evidence that time limits would do that?
So a small group of housing authorities actually have had the power from Congress for decades now to impose time limits. Some of them have. And the record is mixed. Josh Meehan advocates for this group. He also leads Keene Housing in New Hampshire, which used to have a 5-year time limit. But when that deadline approached to cut off people's aid, he says it was clear their financial situations had not gotten better.
Their incomes hadn't moved appreciatively upwards in those 5 years. And so if they had terminated those folks, I mean, I think it's fair to assume they would have wound up back on our waiting lists.
So Keene dropped its time limit. Other places have also done that. You know, they say people's wages just cannot keep up with skyrocketing rents. Now, I did speak with the head of the Delaware State Housing Authority, who says their 5 to 7 year time limit program does help a lot of people. But he said the main reason is not the limit. It's because they also cap rents and they have this automatic savings account and lots of other supports that help tenants. Now, we do not know if the Trump administration rule would include any of that.
Jennifer, let's just flip this around. We've been talking about the impact on renters. What about on landlords, on housing suppliers? I know you have reported housing vouchers are already hard to use in the private market.
This is exactly what the HUD staffer raised, that it would scare off landlords if they had to go through this whole process of finding a new tenant every 2 years. Also, this employee says the prospect of high turnover and vacancies could spook private investors and lenders who finance affordable housing. You know, their deals rely on vouchers for their tenants to pay their rent. And the worry is that if all that were upended, we could just see a lot more homelessness.
That's NPR's Jennifer Ludden. Thank you.
Thank you.
There was a time when many middle-class American homes had a piano. That's been changing for decades, especially with acoustic pianos. Digital piano sales now outnumber those of acoustic pianos 10 to 1. KERA arts reporter Markita Fornoff tells us about how that happened.
Watch this. Here it is. Van Cliburn, Chopin Ballade No. 3 in 1959.
John Suter is showing off the Steinway Spirio grand piano in his Fort Worth home. It's a souped-up acoustic player piano.
There's a computer built into the board, and it's connected to the Steinway server in New York. So I have access to what anything Steinway has.
Including Bruce Springsteen. Suter, an intellectual property lawyer, is one of a dwindling number of Americans buying new pianos. More than half the pianos in the world were once made in the United States, but that was back in 1896.
most people around the 50s, 60s, having a piano in the home was super common. Everybody did it. It was like a primary source of entertainment.
That's Hannah Beckett. She's a piano technician, and she publishes a consumer guide called the Piano Buyer Press.
Around the 70s and 80s, that started to change.
Radio, TV, and electronic keyboards all chipped away at the piano's foothold. Last year, fewer than 18,000 acoustic pianos were sold in the U.S., compared to 188,000 digital pianos. So, who's buying acoustic pianos? Professional musicians, concert halls, and music schools. Carol Leone is chair of piano studies at Southern Methodist University. That's her playing the piano. She says Americans are still studying piano, but in smaller numbers.
Parents of American students believe that music is not going to be a lucrative profession for their children. And therefore, even though they might advocate for them to study the piano, it's seen as a supplement to their education.
And often, when kids' interests shift, they sell their pianos. Eleonora Grachowska grew up playing the piano in Ukraine. She lives in North Texas now and purchased a piano 10 years ago for her daughter.
When we reached out to a piano teacher, she said that she would not accept us as students if we only have keyboard.
Now, Grachowska is trying to sell her Yamaha Baby Grand on Facebook Marketplace.
This piano was, since then, the most expensive piece of furniture in my house. And now, since she moved to college, I decided I was going to sell it.
It's hard to track how many instruments are changing hands via secondary sales. But these exchanges keep Diane Bolton busy. She and her husband, Gordon, own Piano Movers of Texas. The company moves about 1,600 pianos a year. Most are family heirlooms. Clients might be downsizing their home, upgrading their instrument, or storing it temporarily. Whatever the reason, moving a piano can be emotional.
Pianos are more than instruments. They're family members and their memories.
Suter agrees. Yes, he bought that fancy new Spirio, but he also kept the 1922 Steinway that he and his siblings took lessons on as kids. For NPR News, I'm Markita Fornoff in Dallas.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.